Welcome back to Insights Now. I'm Gabriela Santos, Chief Market Strategist for the Americas at JP Morgan Asset Management. Within our financial system, the idea that the Federal Reserve should operate as an independent entity is absolutely fundamental. Importantly, the Federal Reserve is a political institution that's accountable to Congress and also the public, and its independence ensures that it can conduct monetary policy in a way that it perceives to be in support of its dual mandate without undue political pressures. But some candidates on the campaign trail have expressed interest in giving other branches of government a say in the Fed's decision-making, meaning that this election could have major implications for the ways that monetary policy is conducted, its efficacy, and the public's confidence in the central bank. To explore the implications of any changes to the Federal Reserve's independence, I'm excited to be back with Dr. David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. Welcome, David.
I'm glad to be here.
Now, if you're listening to the audio version of this podcast, you can now also watch along on YouTube by tuning in to our JP Morgan Asset Management channel, linked in the show notes. Now, let's get started, David. So we talk about the Fed a lot, but just step back, remind us, where exactly does the Federal Reserve sit within the broader political system?
Well, I think that the Fed tries very hard to be independent. I think, you know, having watched Greenspan, Bernanke, Yellen, now Powell, each of these Fed chairmen and chairwomen have done their very best to stay apolitical. So that means that they're not going to answer questions about what do you think about this candidate, this president, that president. They also take monetary or fiscal policy as given. So what they're saying, you know, they're not even going to speculate about what fiscal policy might be, but fiscal policy can affect the economy. So what Congress does or what the administration does affect the landscape, and they react to that. But their rule has been, as an institution, that they are not going to tell Congress and the administration how to run fiscal policy, and in return, they expect that Congress and the administration will not tell them how to run monetary policy. They have some protection in terms of the structure of the Federal Reserve so that that can be implemented, but it's still a matter of goodwill on both sides to try to maintain that independence.
David, in terms of fiscal policy, your point's really important. They take it as a given in the sense that, one, it's implemented, yeah, right, rather than in advance. So, David, in terms of the Fed being a political entity, when was it established as an independent one? And are there any laws to keep this in place?
Yes, the original Federal Reserve Act of 1913 established the Federal Reserve really to try to deal with bank runs and financial panics, most recently at that time, the financial panic of 1907. Which actually J.P. Morgan managed to deal with because there wasn't a central bank. But the United States had been plagued by financial panics, and it had not had a central bank. It had a lot of individual little banks who would tend to go bust, and that would cause economic turmoil. So the Federal Reserve was established in 1913 with that primary purpose, to bring about financial and therefore economic stability. And it always was, to a degree, independent. There are two sort of groups in it. There are the 12 regional Federal Reserves, there are members to the Federal Market Open Committee who come from there. And then there are seven governors, and the regional banks appoint their own presidents, and they are generally from the banks in the local area, had traditionally been where these leaders came from. And then on the governors, there is a fairly structured approach. You get two up to seven-year terms. You can only serve twice, and they're staggered every 2 years. Somebody rolls off, and it's kind of like other important offices in the federal government. The president nominates somebody, but then they have to be confirmed by the Senate. And so there is, obviously, over time, just like the Supreme Court, the Senate and the administration working together could change the overall shape of the Federal Reserve, but it is designed to be a slow process. And then separately to that, the president appoints the chairman of the Federal Reserve or chairwoman of the Federal Reserve, and they serve up to, usually it's, I think, two 4-year terms, but actually I think they can serve more than that.
And it's interesting that there's the staggered approach,
yep,
so that each election cycle, it's not like you get a complete turnover of the entire institution.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of think that perhaps ought to be how we approach the Supreme Court, but we don't. But in the Supreme Court, you're appointed for life. In the Federal Reserve, it's up to 14 years, and that's it.
Mm. In what ways, David, I mean, historically or currently, can the president actually impact the Federal Reserve? You mentioned the appointments, of course, and the appointment of the chair. But beyond that, how can they impact it? And are there any other political entities that can influence monetary policy?
Well, yes. I mean, I think the president's primary ability to impact the Federal Reserve, if that president really wanted to do it, would be, first of all, who they appoint to the Federal Reserve Board. And then also, I believe they have the ability to fire the chair of the Federal Reserve, although they can't kick him or her off the board, which is kind of interesting. So they can, that does have some impact. But also, I think the weight of politics, if the president's yelling at you to do something, then, you know, nobody's an island here. So people aren't quite immune to that. And that can have an impact on Federal Reserve decisions, despite the very best attempts of the Federal Reserve to try to, be independent. The other thing to recognize is, okay, so the Fed was set up in 1913 with a goal of promoting financial stability. And for a long time, that was thought to be, well, promote a low and stable rate of inflation and interest rates. But in 1977, there was a new Federal Reserve Act of 1977 in which they switched to a dual mandate, probably in reaction to the stagflation recessions of, and particularly the first one, of the early 1970s, where you got a spike in both unemployment and inflation. It was clear that the Federal Reserve really, if monetary policy is going to affect the economy overall, they really ought to look at both unemployment and inflation as goals, apart from financial stability. And so since then, they have that, and they're required to report to Congress twice a year. Jay Powell will go to both House committees and Senate committees to re-testify on the conduct of the monetary policy, and the Fed is answerable to Congress in that respect. But if the Congress wants to change the rules of the road, the Congress would have to essentially pass a new Federal Reserve Act.
That's a question we get frequently. Can the Fed just change its inflation target, for example? And it's important to keep in mind that these goals really come from Congress and need to be changed by Congress.
Well, yes. I will say that Congress doesn't mandate the 2% inflation target. So it does mandate that they need to achieve stable prices and maximum employment. But it is up to the Federal Reserve to define what stable prices and maximum employment is. And in their summary of economic projections, the Federal Reserve essentially updates us every 3 months on where they think maximum employment is in the long run. That's where they, in the long run, they think the unemployment rate will be. But with regard to inflation, they've picked a number of 2% year over year on the personal consumption deflator as their inflation target. They regard that as being consistent with stable prices. But it ultimately is the Federal Reserve's decision as to what they're going to call stable prices.
That's interesting. And David, having, you know, done research on a whole variety of different central banks, it's such a unique setup here in the U.S., this idea of a dual mandate. A lot of other central banks just focus on the inflation side. Yeah. So that has given the Fed a little bit more flexibility at times to have both sides. And then also this idea of a truly independent central bank with a lot of checks and balances there. You mentioned the president can fire the chair, but with due cause, right?
Yes.
Just for political interference.
Well, I suppose that's true. Although I suppose you could cook up due cause in any way you wanted, so it would end up in the courts. But I do think this matter of central bank independence is so important. I mean, obviously you've come from Brazil. You've covered central banks, which went wild before, and you can see from the history of Latin America and South America just how dangerous a captive central bank is. And of course, that's the threat, because a government may decide that they want to do all sorts of things, and they need somebody to print money for them or to lend money to them at low rates. And if the central bank is co-opted into doing that, they can end up, yes, they finance a government for a while, but that can lead to excess demand. You end up with runaway inflation, particularly in a small economy, that can cause your currency to crash, and you end up with a very bad economic result. You know, one of the reasons that is such a problem is that if you behave recklessly in terms of fiscal policy, and if that is accommodated by monetary policy, you get the good stuff first and the bad stuff later. So you can put in all this stuff. Oh, we're going to do this for you and that for you and something else for you, and you get economic growth to start with, and then you get inflation later. And so, generally speaking, timelines in fiscal policy or in politics are much shorter than in monetary policy. So it's very important for the Federal Reserve to think about, and for any central bank to think about, what's this going to do in the long run to the economy.
It can be very counterproductive to have these partisan influences on the central bank.
Absolutely. And particularly, you can see this in the United States today, where we've got massive deficits. You really don't want the central bank co-opted into financing these deficits or any plan to increase spending on one side or to cut taxes on another side. The Federal Reserve really ought to set policy. They can't set fiscal policy, but they should set monetary policy with an eye to what fiscal policy is in place to try to maintain maximum employment and stable prices.
Yeah. David, historically, have there been instances where the independence of the central bank has been tested?
There have. Generally speaking, we've seen, some of this in the 1970s, where we had very high inflation. We had some pressure being put on the Federal Reserve, but I think it was relatively minor. And certainly, the institution of the Federal Reserve held very well. And in fact, rather famously, Jimmy Carter, when he appointed Paul Volcker as head of the Federal Reserve in the later years of his first and only term. Paul Volcker said to him, I'm going to kill the economy when I try and kill inflation. And, Jimmy Carter basically said, well, that's your decision. I'm still going to appoint you. But there would have been, there was a lot of political pushback on the Federal Reserve allowing inflation to get out of hand in the first place. And, of course, there's pushback coming from economists as well as politicians. But I will say that also under the Trump presidency, we did see a lot of verbal pushing of the Federal Reserve to do this or to do that from President Trump, which was a little unusual. I think that under previous presidents, both Democratic and Republican, they generally try to, when the issue of interest rates comes up, they say, look, that's up to the Federal Reserve. And they have very much respected that space between the administration and the Federal Reserve as an institution.
Must be tempting as a politician to kind of blame the Fed for one thing or another, but in terms of actual influence on what they're doing.
Well, yeah, the advantage of being able to say, well, that's the Fed's decision, is you can then put the blame on the Fed if something goes wrong.
Yeah. And in terms of where we sit today, where, a month around there from the election, what's your outlook for monetary policy?
Well, at the moment, I think that we will see a gradual easing of monetary policy. The Federal Reserve there was a question, would they start with a 25 basis point cut or a 50 basis point cut? And they decided to go big and cut by 50 basis points. And often in the past, that has been, a little nerve-wracking because it tends to cause, people to get scared and then the economy could slow down just because of that, the messaging the Fed is sending. This time around, the data that we've seen since the Fed's decision in the middle of September have actually been pretty okay. The new GDP data, the revised GDP data suggests that we're on track to somewhere in a 2-3% growth rate for the third quarter, which is fine. The inflation rate is gradually coming back down to 2%. So the Fed is still on track for this soft landing. And if we do that, I think the Federal Reserve will try to stick to their dots, so to speak. So right now, they've got another 50 basis points in cuts forecast for this year, and then 100 basis points in cuts next year. And while futures markets are pricing in more than that, I think the Federal Reserve would really like to stick with that because it does send a message that nothing to watch here. We're basically on track here. And that's a very good message for the economy and for business and for markets. If the Federal Reserve can say, look, we can gradually bring rates back to neutral here, but there's no particular hurry because we really are pretty much on the track that we wanted to be on.
And we have the Fed meeting starting at an odd time during the week because of the election on Tuesday and then the Fed meeting a little bit later.
Well, that's right. And it's just one more instance of how the Federal Reserve tries to get out of the way of politics. Mm-hmm. So they usually have a meeting at the end of October, except in election years. And election years, they put it after the election day precisely because they don't want to be seen as influencing the election one way or the other. I think it's very wise. Although I suppose the counting of the election will probably still be going on by the time the Fed meets 2 days after the votes are cast.
So they're aware of the political calendar. They're just trying not to be partisan.
Exactly. They're very aware of politics. They're just trying not to be in the middle of it.
And once we do get the results of the election, is there anything there and throughout 2025 that might impact the trajectory of rates?
Oh, yeah, there is. Because if we have divided government, with, for example, the Republicans taking the Senate and the Democrats taking the House, it is unlikely that major fiscal legislation will get through that would be very expansionary. But if you had a one-party sweep, then you might get more expansionary fiscal policy. If you have things like a one-time $25,000 tax credit for first-time home buyers, if you decide you're going to eliminate taxes on tips, you're going to reduce capital gains taxes, you're going to reduce corporate taxes. You know, all these things cost money. We're already on a trajectory by which the debt is going to go from about 100% of GDP right now up to about 133% of GDP if you just extend all the tax cuts from the 2017 tax cuts. If you have a more expansionary fiscal policy on top of that, that could well cause the Federal Reserve to lean more heavily against what the government's doing. And that could be an interesting situation because the Federal Reserve will keep an eye on the economy, and that's what their focus is. But if fiscal policy is making the economy overheat, the Federal Reserve may push up interest rates to really counteract the effect of fiscal policy, which may not be too pleasant for the administration at that time.
And this is in the sense of when it's actually implemented and starts impacting their economic
variables. That's right. Jay Powell made it quite clear that that he is not going to try and guess on the election outcome or the direction of fiscal policy after the election. But that once it is clear what that is, they will have to, you know, factor that in to their decision making.
Understood. So a lot to watch for in 2025, especially around fiscal policy and what happens with individual taxes.
Absolutely.
How that impacts monetary policy. David, thank you so much for joining me today. On our next episode, join David and me for a discussion on fiscal policy as we dive deeper into taxes, deficits, and the federal debt. There's clearly a lot to unpack there. And until then, check out our Election Insights Hub at jpmorgan.com/elections for more timely election content. To all our viewers and listeners, thank you for tuning in today, and we'll speak to you soon.
This content is intended for information only, based on assumptions and current market conditions, and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.